use a feller buncher to snip the trees, cut them off, and bring them, use the skidder and the loader. Some people still continue to use the chainsaws, while others might, like yourselves, use the crosscut saw to do some of your logging work there. But there's other things you can do with I call it an instrument right away, the tool. The tool can become an instrument and become an instrument, a musical instrument, in fact. And Lynn Wallenley has been, pardon the pun, sharpening her skills so that she can demonstrate the beauty of the instrument that does the beautiful work. So Lynn Wallenley and friend.
Oh, I should tell you Doug's name. He's been helping me all weekend. He's a really good friend. Thank you, yes. This is Doug Pease from Connecticut. And I'll tell you, this weekend just wouldn't have been the same for me without his help everywhere I've been. Well, beauty, I wouldn't say, is a word that people generally choose to describe my saw playing, but I appreciate it. How many people did catch me playing the saw sometime during the weekend besides this nice gentleman here? Okay, some others. You know, what I'm trying to see is whether I really have to try to do some different songs or not. About 2 years ago, I just decided to add the saw because I thought it'd be fun to have a couple of saw numbers to do. I thought I could fool people into thinking that I was a real good folk performer. The more instruments I carried along, they think she must be good. So I played it for about 20 minutes a day for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And then I played it for about 20 minutes a day for about a week and a half last year. And this year, I just put a little PS. By the way, I sort of play the saw a little bit, because I sing and I play guitar and I songwrite and I play the dulcimer. And what do you suppose they picked up on? A saw player. And I said, oh my God, when I got that letter and they said, play the saw for us 4 times this weekend. Gee whiz, that's as much as I've played in the whole year put together. But believe me, I have now played an hour a day since I got the letter. My housemate is going to be so happy that this festival is over. So we're going to try a song that we haven't ever done before, which is, believe me, It Follows Enduring Young Charms. Played that before. I never played that before on the saw. And that is the thing about the saw that makes it very appealing to somebody like me who is not an accomplished instrumentalist. I can't back up friends on the guitar without, you know, really thinking and working and making mistakes. It has to be in a certain key and all that. With this, it's like if you could hum it. If you could play 10 songs, you should be able to play 100 songs on the saw, because it's sort of like hum it for me, and that's really all I'm doing. I don't know where to go to find the notes. I just sort of get an idea, and when it's not quite on, I just sort of keep on going till hopefully I find it. Once in a while, I look for a note and just don't find it at all. And that's why I've been having nightmares for about the last 2 weeks. You know, I've been coming to White Springs to have you all know who I am, and now this is what everybody's going to think. The sound on the musical saw is made from having a double bend. You've got this bend, of course, as it comes off your leg, but you have to have a double bend, an S-shaped curve. And see, you get it by pushing with your thumb here near the end and having the other curve made as it comes over your leg. If you didn't have the double curve, if you just had a curve, you don't get anything, even if you weren't shaking the leg. Okay. The shaking the leg makes the sound pretty, but it doesn't get you the sound. So the note changes as you change the curve, assuming that you've got an S-shaped curve. This saw was made to be a musical saw. They figured out how to temper the steel to make it a little nicer sound, and especially to make it able to do high notes and maybe low notes a little bit better. But this week, for the first time, I wanted to play a real saw so that I could say you all could play probably a saw that you have in your, wherever it is you keep your saw, your workshop, or your garage, or your basement. So I want to show you how you might start if you thought that this might be fun for you to goof your friends like I did mine, or for your friends to tell you, well, please come over, but please leave your saw home. Well, so you just take, this is my son's saw. He just loaned it to me the other day. He's been working on the room for the new baby coming. It costs $9.50. It still has the price on it. And if you didn't already have a violin, bow, and rosin at home, which I realize a few people might not just have that already, then just take a wooden spoon or a chopstick or anything like that. You do have to get that double bend. And start seeing how, when you hit it, you get different notes. Okay? And then when somebody says, what's going on in there, then you might want to put something to have not quite such a loud thunk. I just put a paper towel and elastic band around the end of it so you can hear the saw more. Okay, you notice this is with no leg shaking. You notice that, right? Huh? Now this really is not bad. This saw is not bad, and in fact if I bowed it, I could play you a pretty song. Maybe I will in a minute. But as I'm thinking of you all going home and trying it, let's see what you might do. Odds are really good that if you hum around or even sing in the shower, that you could do that, if not in the first 10 minutes. Some people I know do it in 10 minutes, but you could probably do it the second day. That is really easy. If you don't hum, if you can't hear when something is untuned, then you probably just can't play the tune. You need something where there's a certain place to go to get it. Then this leg stuff here, just puts the vibrato on it so that if it's ever going to sound good, this is the only chance it's got, is to have that leg going. And some people have a real little, like a little mallet that's very softly padded. And in fact, that's so easy to get going on that a lot of people just don't really want to give up the mallet because it is so easy. And they don't want to get a bow. But I think probably you need to if you really want to make the saw sound really pretty good. You know, after a week, if you want to still be playing it, you probably want to invest in the cheapest bow you can possibly find, maybe at a yard sale or something. This one I bought at a music store, and it was $30, and he said that's the cheapest bow. That's just sound. That's not a song. That's what I always say when I can't find the song I'm looking for. What might we try?
How about song?
Did we do Orly?
We have a little Orly.
Let's do Orly, okay? Because I sort of clunked out Swanee River. This is the cheap saw, mind you. Thank you. When I got that letter 2 weeks ago, right after I said, oh my gosh, I said, boy, I wish I knew where Jean Mahaffey lives. I know she lives in Florida now, and she is an excellent musical saw player. And what do you suppose? Who walked up to me the other day? Jean, who I had met a couple times before, but especially up in Elkins, West Virginia, where we were both studying a little bit of music 1 week. So I asked her to come and do a number for you, and if there's still time, we just might attempt one together. We've just ever done that once, and it might work and it might not, but if you're game, we might be. Depends on what's coming up in 5 minutes.
Lunch?
And also, anybody who wants to stay on for about 10 minutes,
this is imposing.
You're very welcome to try it. I'd be happy for you to try and get that curve and get the right plus.
No guarantees, no guarantees.
I take it all down.
We're going to try a good old hymn, What a Friend We Have in Jesus.
When I saw Jean, she came and joined me here just like she's doing now. And we tried two, and one of them worked very nicely, and the other one wasn't bad considering, but I don't think we would get a prize probably for either one. Rosin? Anybody see where I put the, oh, my, is my bow down there? Then I put it over. But at that time, we could at least say that we hadn't ever done it before, which we can't quite say, almost. Would you please start it, and I'll see what I can do without harmonizing.
Amazing
Grace.
And
G. Okay. Give us the three chords, please. Could you help it?
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
If you have a minute, too, maybe if somebody wants to try it,
we could. Let me just break
this
for a moment. No.
Okay.
Let me tell people what's coming up here. Okay, what we're going to do here is just take this sort of informal break. There'll be a lunch break. 12:45, come on back if you want to learn how to put out a fire. Okay, we'll start back with the workshops. 12:45, and in the meantime, just have fun being here, okay?
Thanks a lot. You suppose saw music could put out a...
...land prepared for the trees. We got the trees planted, the trees have grown, the trees have harvested. It's just rained. We've had some lightning. We got a big old fire, and we're going to learn how to put it out. Today, this workshop is about firefighting, but firefighting and is not the only thing... people who work in the forest industries do. We have, I can't remember your name.
My name is Frank Sorrells.
Hey, Mr. Sorrells, and I can't remember yours either.
Steve Robbins.
Okay, to talk about working with fire. And perhaps, Mr. Sorrells, you can tell us a little bit about exactly what is it that you do with fire, because it is more than fighting fires, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I am employed with the Florida Division of Forestry, and within this organization, not only do we do fight fires, we also are part of the forest management aspect of it, the forest education of more or less prevention of fires. We do a lot of control burning to reduce the vegetative matter that accumulates on the ground in case a wildfire starts. So there's a lot of aspects within forestry we deal with other than firefighting. But firefighting originally started within our organization as being having top priority back early 40s and 50s, when after all the disastrous fires and regeneration was occurring, they seen a need that fires were becoming a problem. So they formed our fire control bureau, so to speak, and we really expounded on that in the last years and really got down to a scientific art.
So you just mentioned the term controlled burn. Perhaps you can talk about the different kinds of fires you work with and what they do.
Okay. Our main concern is the wildfires that occur in the state of Florida. These are fires that do damage due to the intent of the fire, the flames. But there's also another aspect we deal with quite often is a controlled burn. This is a fire established in the woods or the forest for many different reasons. One, having high priority is reduce the accumulation of buildup of vegetative layers you probably see on the ground. Maybe you can see how the leaves fall in the yard, and they just get deeper and deeper every year if you don't rake them up or do something with them. Same thing happens in the forest, and this accumulates over a period of time. And if a wildfire does occur, that causes more intense flames and can do more damage. It could make the fire spread rapidly and possibly do harm to wildlife and other things. So that's, if a control burn is established, it's under the correct weather conditions. Weather is a major factor in our control burning. You have to have the right winds, humidity levels, and a lot of different things have to be took into consideration before a control burn is established.
What do you actually do with a fire?
Talking about a wildfire?
Yeah, but the wildfire, say, how do you fight it? First, how do you find out what's going on? The woods are pretty big.
Okay.
It's kind of hard.
Okay, within the state of Florida, we have a network of fire towers. These are lookout towers, some are ranging from 80 to 100 foot in height. We have people that are assigned to that duty of sitting in the fire tower and watching for smoke. If a smoke is picked up by one of our fire towers, it is turned in through radio communications with our central dispatch point. And on that board, they have inside the office, they have a big board or a big map of the entire area. It could usually involve 3 to 6 counties. And we have a system of burning authorization program where people will call us and tell us they're going to be burning for certain reasons within an area, and we will map it and put it on our map and plot it. And then as our towers pick it up, if they see somebody's control burn, we know that's what it is, and they're no use to send individual or a ranger like Mr. Roberts out to check on it. We know what's going on there. If a smoke occurs or comes up within an area and we know nothing about it, our towers will get a fix on it, a reading on it. It's called an alidade. It's in the tower. It's just like a circle. It consists of 360 degrees. They can look through this thing and get a reading on it, and we can get other towers to pick it up and cross it out. It's called a triangulation system. We can pull the strings on the maps, and we can locate the fire where it's at, then we'll dispatch a crew to it.
Okay, so once now you found the fire and you got to dispatch the crew, what does the crew have to do? First, you can't go fighting fires in your Reeboks and shorts, can you, Mr. Roberts? Can you tell us something about the kind of gear you're going to need when you go to that fire?
Okay, I'll let Mr. Roberts handle it. He's got it with him.
Yeah, fire fashion show.
Yeah, you have your hard hat, your safety glasses, a shield, you have gloves, and you have a fire shirt. And most rangers have fire-retarded pants and boots. They are required on a fire. And when you get to the fire, the first thing you do is size it up as you're approaching the fire, which you look up, you see which way the smoke is going. You look at your natural barrier, which would be a road, a pond, or a river. And you do not jump on the fire and try to keep the fire from going into a road when you got thousands of acres of trees over here. You use the road as a natural barrier, and therefore you hit the fire and try to keep as many trees as possible from burning. And when you get there, you unload, you make sure you have all your gear on, you unload your tractor safely, you plan an escape route in case something happened, the wind shift. Some days you have variable wind, some days you have wind out of certain direction. You make sure you have an escape route so when you get out there fighting the fire, and something changed, the wind changed direction, or you have a blow up in front of you, you can be able to get away from the fire.
Huh, so now I noticed there on your helmet, you have a way that you can, I guess, keep away from some noise, but also when you go into the fire, you don't go in by yourself. Now, do you maintain contact with the people you're working with in the fire as well as outside of the fire?
Yes, we have radios in our trucks, and we have radios on the tractor. And periodically, about every 5 minutes, the dispatch will either call us or we will call the dispatch to let them know the condition of the fire, the condition of the tractor, or the personnel that's on the fire to make sure everything is all right.
Okay, now you just said that you use a tractor. You mean you don't go in there with fire extinguishers and you know, the kind you find, like, maybe, hopefully, in the buildings here or a regular garden hose or anything like that? You got to use some other kind of equipment, huh?
And we have different equipment. We have bulldozers with plows behind it. We have power wagons, which is a tanker on wheels that have hoses. We have hand tools, which we hope we don't have to ever use. It's the bulldozer and plow we use.
What kind of hand tools? You like axes and the
like? Axes, shovels, uh-huh. Council rake, flaps, which get rusty every night.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, for those of you interested, the tractor and fire plow are just out over there. I never thought of fire as something you could run over, you know. But somebody described fighting a fire as
removing the vegetation ahead of the fire. I can expound on that a little bit. In structure-type fires, what you do with water is you cool the flame or cool the fuel down to it to a point it will not ignite. That's what you do with water. A lot of people think you smother it or whatever. You don't. You cool the fuel down, which could be lumber, shingles, couches, whatever. That's the fuel burning in a structure. And that's the best possible way to fight structure fires. For woods fires or forest fires, the best possible way is to remove the fuel ahead of the fire so when it gets there, it is starved of fuel and there's nothing there for it to burn. So the fire plow is what we use mostly in the southeast. You'll see us using some of our hand tools to smother the fire. One of them is the flap. You put the flap on top of the flame if the flame is small enough, and it will smother the flame. It will drive it of oxygen and it will go out. So fire's kind of neat. Fire's like a triangle. You got to have three things to have a fire. You got to have fuel, which could be woods, trees, vegetation. It could be couches. It could be boards. It could be roofing shingles. But that's still fuel. Whatever will burn is your fuel. Then you got to have oxygen, and oxygen is everywhere. And it's everywhere in the around us. It just happens. So that's nothing to worry about. So you always got oxygen. And then the next, you got to have heat. You got to have enough heat to make an ignition. And then once there's an ignition factor there, you have heat. So anytime you take one of the legs of the triangle out, it could be the oxygen, it could be the fuel, or it could be the heat, you no longer have fire. So we work on the fuel part. We remove the fuel.
Remove the fuel.
Yeah. And we take the fuel away. So that's how we do it. And with structure type fires where they're working with water and foam a lot, you know, that's they reduce the heat, and then throwing dirt on fire smothers it, so there's removing the oxygen. So there's different ways of doing it. Yeah.
What happens though? Okay, Mr. Roberts, you've gotten into that fire, you've got the plow, you've plowed it over as much as you can, and all of a sudden those flames start running at you. And you don't have a way out anymore. What are you going to do?
Well, then, that's what, on my side here, but I can take it off. That's where the fire tent come in handy. And she asked me yesterday, do I have a nickname for it? I told her all I could call it is a lifesaver. And the first thing you do when you have a fire that's coming at you, you have nowhere to go, you pick an area that has the less fuel possible in it. And if you have time before the fire get there, if you have a shovel or concentrate, you get there and try to scrape the little fuel you have that's there. Scrape you a clean plate big enough for the tent, which usually is an 8x10, I believe. And you deploy your tent, which is open like a little Boy Scout tent. It's triangle shape. It's usually for one person, but two people can get into the tent. And once you deploy the tent and lay down, you lay face down with your face against the ground. You do not use anything wet because moisture have a tendency to generate humidity, which is hot. And long as that tent is hot, you lay still. You do not move until the tent become cool. And when the tent becomes cool, 9 times out of 10, the fire has left you and it's cooled and the smoke be done settled down a little bit.
Coast is clear. So you actually, do you lay down in it and cover? Do you cover yourself in that triangle, or do you cover yourself like a blanket in a way, a big old blanket?
Well, the tent is usually enough. You have on your safety gear, your helmet, and your gloves, and your boots, and the tent knocks away 95% of the heat.
Man, it must get hot in there.
It's like the tent is made out of a fire-resistant material, and it's got a coating of a type. It looks like a anybody ever baked a potato and wrapped it in tinfoil? It's got a tinfoil type exterior to it, reflects the heat. But from experiences of people that have deployed your shelter on fire, it does become quite hot. But you have to think about how hot it is in the tent and how hot it is outside the tent where you want to be.
Right. Inside, fuel or fuel, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask? Yes, ma'am.
Okay, we do have some of those type fires in our area. Those are called ground fires. They burn the muck layer that accumulates over thousands of years. And it has become real dry. Back, you probably read about in the paper, heard it on the local news, that of a fire we had up here in Baker County, which I'm from, a little over 15,000 acres. And it's burning currently in muck. That's all that's really burning is a lot of muck. Those type fires move real slow, usually don't create a problem other than the smoke. The smoke can become, it's very nuisance. It smells bad. It causes lung irritations. If you get the muck on you, it causes skin problems. So there's a lot of hazards in fighting muck fires, but they're not really other than just maybe falling into a burnt muck pocket where it's real soft and all you have is ashes and getting burned or something like that. The only way to do it is flood the area. We have big muck, what we call muck pumps. They're like big irrigation pumps. And if we've got a water source close where we can spot that pump and run large irrigation pipes, we'll do that and just flood the area. Or we get a lot of rain, one or the other.
What kind of fire right now is the fire that's going on in the Everglades?
What kind of fire?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a surface fire. So if it's in sawgrass. If any of you know from that area, it's all sawgrass fire. There's no timber resources being threatened at this time. A lot of wildlife, I understand, being threatened and killed, but mostly just in sawgrass.
How do you fight it?
How do you fight it? Mm. Okay, you got to understand some areas of Florida are set aside as wilderness or natural areas. And if fires occur within these areas, they're allowed to burn to a point as long as they're not threatening life or property. And this type of fire, I understand, in the Everglades is not one of these fires, but they're having more or less like a limited action. They're only doing it with hand tools. They're not putting the bulldozers and the big heavy equipment in there because of tearing up maybe more than what the fire, doing more damage than what the fire's doing. So they're fighting it with hand tool crews. These are crews put in on the fire line with hand tools, and they're doing it that way. They're doing it with some aerial support with helicopters and air tankers. We are in that real heavily. They use that a lot out west in the mountainous regions where inaccessibility is a problem. That's why we're fighting those fires.
Hmm. What's the worst fire you've ever been in, Mr. Roberts?
The worst fire would probably have to be the Crane Swamp Fire back in 1981 down in Volusia County.
What happened?
It was a lot of fire. And it was 16-hour days. And most of all, it was an area that I'm not familiar with. That's one thing about a ranger, who you have to look around and be familiar with the area. In that area, I'm not familiar with it. So if something would have happened, if I had not looked around at the road barriers, the natural barriers, or picked me an escape route, I wouldn't know which way to go because it's dangerous.